This was because, more than any other figure in the Reformation, I think Calvin understood the incredible power of music. There is scarcely in the world anything which is more available to turn or bend this way and that the morals of men, Calvin wrote in his preface to the Genevan Psalter. And in fact, we find by experience, he goes on, that it has a sacred and almost incredible power to move hearts in one way or another. In speaking now of music, I understand two parts, namely the letter or the subject matter, secondly the song or the melody. It is true that every bad word, as St. Paul has said, perverts good manner. But when the melody is with it, it pierces the heart more strongly and enters into it. In a like manner as through a funnel the wine is poured into the vessel, so also the venom and corruption is distilled into the depths of the heart by the melody. Calvin's point, I believe, was to disallow any melody that was not in keeping with the integrity of the word being sung, or disallow any tune that by appeal to unreflective emotions would distract faith from its search for understanding. While as Calvin's heirs, we do not adhere to the letter of his exegesis of our text. As heirs of a church that is reformed and always being reformed, I think we mean to adhere to the Spirit. For instance, the text of the hymns we sing and of the anthems offered by the choir must be consistent with Scripture and theologically sound. Likewise, the music will be music whose excellence draws out the depth of a text's meaning. In the words of another Presbyterian church, and borrowing the words of Paul to Christians in Philippi, the music appropriate to the worship of God should be noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable, excellent, and praiseworthy. Moreover, the music of the church must have integrity, defined as the overall truthfulness of a work. Such integrity demands that any joining Calvin in his distaste for instruments in worship. He writes that it is hard to see any compelling reason that why the congregation should have to be accompanied in their singing by an organ. Nevertheless, Bart goes on to acknowledge that in the organ's sound and swell, it might be argued that the community's praise of God is embedded by anticipation in that of the whole cosmos, to which the cosmos is undoubtedly called, and to which we shall unquestionably hear in the consummation. To wit, the heavens are telling the glory of God, sings the psalmist, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. Where were you, roars God to Job, when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly hosts shouted for joy? The Lord created me at the beginning of the earth, says wisdom. When he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master worker, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always. The organ plays the part of the otherwise in an audible cosmos as the congregation joins the music of the spheres. What was this music? This fundamental belief in the unity of the cosmos, known to the psalmists, to the writers of wisdom, even to the Apostle Paul, who said, everything makes a sound. In the 6th century BC, the century that found the Israelites hanging up their harps by the rivers of Babylon and weeping as they sang the songs of Zion for their captors, the quasi-mythical Greek figure of Pythagoras came upon the sublime harmony of the cosmos that had sounded from the beginning of creation. He had inherited a poetic cosmology and so imagined spheres moving around a cylindrical earth, a notion that led him to connect his discovery of the mathematical basis for musical intervals to the mathematical elegance ordering the physical universe. Certainly, the spheres made sounds as they turned round and round the orb of the earth. Those sounds of necessity being musical and harmonious, a vast lyre with crystal spheres in the place of strings. The harmonious unity of the cosmos became a theme that resounded in the depths of the human psyche. From Pythagoras to Plato, to Clement of Alexandria, to Augustine, to assorted medieval monks, to the great chain of being in the 14th century, there is no worm that crawls upon the earth, no bird that flies on high, no fish that swims in the depths which the chain of this order does not bind in the most harmonious concord. To John Milton, who in the wake of the reformers wrote, "But else in deep of night, when drowsiness hath locked up mortal sense, then I listen to the celestial siren's harmony Reformation Sunday. The gospel is simply and profoundly this: that the music of the spheres of which we are partakers as we sing God's praises can be but a poor echo of the harmony that is God. Our enjoyment of God, writes theologian and friend of this congregation, Robert Jensen, is that we are taken in to the triune singing. Perhaps we may say we are allowed to double the parts, a congregation singing a hymn of praise to the Father is doubling the Son's praise. And the surge of rhythm and melody is the surge of the Spirit's glorification of the Father and the Son. God is a great fugue. There is nothing so capacious as a fugue. At the almost end of this season wherein we have asked after the foundation of this house, may I also nominate singing, which is to nominate no less than the conversation, the harmony, the pure music that is God. I say this pastorally as we are surrounded by the harshness and discord of the world. How much more do we come these days in need of a new harmony that shall return us to our duties with fresh courage, with rejoicing,